The statue means all of this was her doing. Being the leader wasn't enough for Matilda. She wanted to be worshipped. Aramovsky is at my side. Our two grown-ups were together when we found them. His voice is smooth, calm, and low, the hiss of a smiling snake. The circles and the double rings working together. You and I working together. This was meant to be. Remember how I told you I wanted to help you lead? This is a sign, Em. A sign that can't be ignored. He doesn't even know the proper terms. He means spirit and service working together. Did my progenitor and his cooperate to create this nightmare? I feel ill. Aramovsky makes me sick. This place makes me sick. This entire planet makes me sick. We woke up in coffins and fought our way off an orbiting tomb, only to inherit a city of death. O'Malley approaches. Get away from her, Aramovsky. She doesn't need your whispered lies. The tall boy grins. Because whispering in her ear is your job? O'Malley's right hand flexes, fingers opening and curling. Like a crawling animal, the hand drifts toward the jeweled handle of his knife. Bishop moves in, his steps noisy, only because he wants us to hear him coming. The sun will set soon, he says. We should continue on. I don't like the idea of being on these steps at night. Neither do I. But should we continue? This place is evil, and we're not even inside yet. O'Malley is ready to attack Aramovsky. Aramovsky suddenly thinks he and I are destined to rule together. And the look on Spingate's face? She's scared of me. Scared and disgusted. I stare at her until she looks away. Arrogant tooth girl. I wonder what she thinks of stupid empties now. Special girl. Rich girl. I remember people like her laughing at me. One of her kind owned me. I remember being afraid to say anything, knowing that my owner could punish me, beat me if she wanted to, that I had no rights. Girls like Spingate liked having power. Now the power has changed hands. Of course she's scared. She should be. My thoughts pause, a moment of blankness, of floundering confusion. What am I thinking? Am I taking joy in Spin's fear? Hatred of her and her kind bubbles and boils. But that hatred isn't mine. It's Matilda's. Spingate has done nothing to me. Those things she said to me in the lab. Is she suffering the same turmoil as I am? Is her sudden prejudice against my kind actually from her progenitor? If I have legacy memories, then Spingate probably does too. These emotions aren't ours. Spin, that statue isn't me. It will never be me. She sniffs. I can tell she wants to believe me, but it must be hard while seeing these images of her kind being tortured, skinned, slaughtered, and with my oh-so-heroic face lording down from above. In a way, it is you, she says. Matilda was your age once. You have her mind. Spingate points to the statue. Like it or not, that's what you could become. This search isn't just about food or the mold. Not anymore. If this building can tell us about our past, help us understand how Matilda turned into a monster that sacrifices gears and halves, that's information we need. Alone, she starts up the thin steps. 5 more steep flights to go. We follow her up. At the 27th plateau, the lush vines start to thin. By the 28th, they don't grow at all, leaving the orange-brown stone exposed. It's colder up here. The wind whips at us. I see heavy clouds coming in from the north, but for now the skies above remain clear. The lack of vines means we see all the images. We can't even look away, because many are carved into the flat fronts of the stairs themselves. We wobble and shudder as we finish the climb. I think I make it up the final steps on willpower alone, because my body gave up on me about 3 layers ago. My legs feel like boiling goo. They burn. They sting. O'Malley is grunting and wheezing. I wonder if he's going to throw up. Aramovsky is worse off. He looks like he might keel over and die at any moment, but that horrid glow remains in his eyes. Even Bishop and Visca are tired, trails of sweat cutting skin-toned streaks through the plant juice on their faces. They have made this climb twice in 2 days. Too much for anyone, even a tireless circle star. Up here, we are no longer sheltered from the wind. It whips us, snaps at our black coveralls. The sun is already heading down to the horizon. The climb took us longer than we had hoped. The fabric that kept us cool now keeps us warm, but our hands and faces feel the wind's biting chill. The last layer is the smallest one, of course. We stand upon a plateau, a square as long as 10 of us, lying head to feet. In the center is a stone slab, and rising up from it, a tall, smooth stone pillar. On it, the 6 gold symbols, each taller than Bishop, from top to bottom, circle, circle star, double ring, circle cross, half circle, and gear. Inside the empty space of the gear, a plaque with a red handprint. In the palm, a golden double ring. All around us, the city seems tiny, insignificant. At 10 layers up, the tops of the tallest pyramids were at eye level. At 20, everything looked small, and we could see a long, long way. Here at the top, 30 layers above the streets, the city below no longer looks real. The observatory is more like a mountain than a building. I can see well past the city walls. Trees, vines, and the ruins of 6-sided buildings blend together, a broken yellow jungle that stretches out and out and out. To the west, far off, mountains rise up. To the north, a sparkling lake with steep cliffs all around. To the northeast is a wide clearing, crescent-shaped like a quarter moon. Maybe someday soon that clearing will be farmland for us, giving us a place to grow crops where we don't have to clear the jungle. The same wind that whips at us is driving those dark clouds toward us. Hidden flashes of lightning flicker within. I hope it doesn't rain. Aramovsky fights away his fatigue, stands to his full height. Atop the city's tallest building, our tallest boy looks important. Regal. "The gods have called to us," he says, almost yelling so that we can hear him over the wind. "They paint a picture of what has been, and what is to come. They will—" "Hold on," O'Malley says. He's at the layer's edge, looking down at his feet. "What do you make of all of this?" He's standing on a black line, so faded none of us noticed it. It's a curve. We all glance around the plateau and see it. The curve is a circle that goes all the way around, touching the edges of the square plateau. And inside it, a second circle. At first, I think it's Aramovsky's double ring. But then I see a dot on the outer circle. The dot is also black. There are 4 of them. If I were to draw lines from plateau corner to plateau corner, the dots are where those lines would intersect the outer circle. And on the middle ring, there are 2 dots. One on either side of the stone pillar. 2 rings. 4 dots on the outer ring. 2 on the inner. I look at Aramovsky. "Do you know what it means?" He walks around staring down. "This entire building has to be a religious place. Some kind of temple. So this symbol is clearly related to mine." He sounds like he's trying to convince himself and failing at it. He has no idea. The wind bites into me. "Try the handprint," I say to him. "I want to get out of here." He walks to the pillar, but doesn't press the handprint. Instead, he tilts his head back and raises his arms to the sky. "O gods, you have chosen for us to be here in this divine place, so that we may live out your plans, and—" Bishop grabs Aramovsky and shakes him. "Just press the damn thing already!" Aramovsky's grand moment is ruined. He's far more worried about his safety than his speech. He presses his hand against the plaque. Nothing happens. A wave of relief washes through me. This entrance, if that's what it is broken. Or Aramovsky is the wrong kind of person. Whatever the reason, we can't get in. I don't have to learn what horrors Matilda planned on committing when she took over my body. A grinding sound. It stops and starts. Silence. We listen for more, but hear only the wind's lonely howl. The plateau trembles beneath us. We are so high up. If the observatory collapses... The pillar shudders. The rectangular slab beneath it rises up, each corner supported by a golden column that reflects the red sun's final light. The bottom of the slab reaches eye level, then shudders to a stop. At our feet, in the space below where the slab was, an intricate metal staircase spirals down into the darkness. If I never see steps again, it will be too soon. As we descend, the dark stone walls start to glow, dimly, but enough that we don't need our flashlights. The sound of the wind fades away. Soon we hear only our breathing and our boots stepping on metal stairs. At least there's no art on these walls. Down and down we go. Bishop first, then Visca, then me, Spingate, Aramovsky, and finally O'Malley. We hold our weapons at the ready. I don't know how long we descend. Long enough that I'm sure the sun has set, that the observatory's long shadow has once again engulfed the shuttle. Finally, the stairs end at a small room with a stone floor. In one wall, a door made of vertical metal bars. Some kind of metallic mesh hangs behind the bars. Next to the door is a plaque with a red handprint. A gold double ring marks the palm. This place has a stale odor. It smells like my coffin room did when I first woke up. I point to the plaque. Aramovsky, open it. He glances at Bishop, then quickly presses his hand to the print. We again hear that sound of struggling machinery. Then, the bars and mesh rattle, kicking off a brief cascade of rust as they slide to the right, revealing a small room. It's an elevator, O'Malley says. I remember those. My heart pounds at the sight of it. I don't want to be sealed up in that tiny space. But what choice do I have? We came here to find answers. If that means getting into a cramped elevator, I have to do it. Everyone inside, I say. It's a tight fit. Bishop keeps his axe close to his chest so as not to accidentally cut anyone. Visca stands his sledgehammer in the corner. Aramovsky and Spingate are armed only with the knives strapped to their thighs, although they have to adjust their black bags to make room. My spear is a bit too tall for the low ceiling. I have to hold it at an angle. O'Malley slides the bars back into place, shutting us in. No plaque in here. No controls that I can see. Without warning, the cage drops. We grab each other out of fear. We're dropping fast. I shut my eyes tight, stifle a scream. My insides feel like they're floating, rising up. We're going to smash into the ground. I should have never got in here. Never. We're going to die. I'm going to die trapped in this tiny box. Spingate's fingers intertwine with mine, clasp tight. Breathe, Em, she says softly. We're fine. I suddenly feel heavier. We're slowing down, she says. Heavier still. The cage bounces slightly. It has stopped. Spingate all but collapses on me, hangs on me laughing. I don't know how to react. A little while ago, she thought I might kill her because of her symbol. She shakes her head and kisses me on the cheek. I'm sorry, Em. I said awful things in the lab. I barely even know where to start with the red mold, and there just isn't enough time. And then all the horrible pictures and carvings on the way up here, it made me so upset. So many images of people killing my kind. I nod. I understand. And also I don't. I've used the phrase my kind, too, so I can't hold that against her. But aren't we all the same kind? She kisses my cheek again, hugs me tight. I know that statue isn't you. You're not like Matilda. You would never do anything like that. The elevator door slides open to darkness. As one, we reach into our bags for our flashlights. Bishop and Visca go first, as always, axe and hammer at the ready. Flashlight beams probing the darkness. The rest of us follow. Our lights play off a curved ceiling made of large stone blocks. Carvings cover the stone walls. These images we've seen before. Ziggurats, cartoonish people, jaguars, suns. Not that far from the elevator, our flashlights light up the soft gleam of dusty metal. Golden coffins. Four of them. On golden risers, so their closed lids are waist high. Laid out side by side, their surfaces are richly detailed with gemstones and the same images we see on the walls. The dust here is thin, not like the thick stuff that coated everything back on the Zolotl. These coffins have no nameplates. Past the coffins is a raised platform with 5 white pedestals. To our left, a tall black X mounted into the floor. Thick shackles dangle from the top of each arm. A bar runs between the tops of those arms. Hanging from that bar, some kind of ornate black crown. On the wall just behind the X, a colorful carved mural. An old man shackled to that same X, wearing that same crown. A young man in red robes before him, driving a knife into the old man's chest. To our right, deep shadows filled with racks of bins similar to what we saw in the food warehouse, except these bins all look empty, and many are scattered about. In the room's center, there is a hole about as wide as I am tall. A waist-high red metal wall surrounds it. A flexible black tube, as thick as my arm, runs from inside that hole, over the wall and under the pedestal platform. Visca and Bishop move through the room, flashlights in one hand, weapons in the other. We give them a few minutes, then everyone starts exploring. I walk to the red wall. Engraved in the metal is a large black symbol. It's like the one from the plateau on top of this building, but slightly different. 2 rings, 4 dots on the outer ring, 2 in the middle ring, but there is also a thick dot in the middle, right where the stone pillar was. Aramovsky, take a look at this. Maybe with the center dot he'll recognize it. He stands at my side, staring at it. He shakes his head. He doesn't know what it is. At least now he admits it. Spingate joins us. Her eyes squint, like a memory is working its way from the depths. I think it's a representation of something, she says. An atom. I think this represents a carbon atom. She points to the 6 dots on the rungs, 1 at a time. These are electrons, I think. And that dot in the middle, that's the nucleus. I look around the room. My flashlight beam seeking out this symbol on the ceiling, the walls, the coffins. I don't find it. All right, I say. So what does it mean? She shrugs. I have no idea. Another useless symbol of the grown-ups. Aramovsky walks to the black X. He seems mesmerized by it. I look down into the hole. The shaft's round wall is nothing but dirt, packed with stones that show white cracks and scrapes from when this hole was dug. Far below, I think I see the bottom. Something metal. A machine, perhaps. The black cable runs into the center of it. Spingate steps onto the pedestal platform. The moment she does, I hear a hum. It's coming from the black cable. The 5 pedestals begin to glow.
Welcome, Grandmaster Spingate.
The voice comes from nowhere, from everywhere. Just like in the shuttle's pilot house, lights suddenly play off Spingate's skin. Her face glows like that of a goddess. She smiles wide. A new puzzle for her. A new problem to solve. Her frustration, fear, and anger are gone. Or at least temporarily forgotten. Do you have a name? She asks.
Much of my memory has been erased. I believe I was referred to as Ometeotl.
Good enough, she says. Can you show me a diagram of this building? Lights flash. In the space above the hole, a glowing version of the observatory appears. The building spins slowly, giving us a look at all 4 sides. Thank you, Spingate says. This place is called the observatory, is that correct?
Yes, Grandmaster.
Spingate nods. That title, Grandmaster, doesn't surprise her. Maybe her lab referred to her by that name, just like the Deck 3 pedestals called O'Malley Chancellor. Observatories are for telescopes, Spingate says. Is there a telescope? The fake ziggurat flashes. The sloping sides become transparent. We see hundreds of rooms and intersecting corridors, but the main feature is a long cylinder that starts at the building's base and rises up at an angle to end just inside one of the sloping walls. The cylinder glows brightly. It is enormous. So big, in fact, I can only come to one conclusion. This observatory was built specifically to house it. Spingate steps off the platform and walks to the glowing ziggurat. She continues to shine, lit up so brightly our flashlights are almost useless. She leans on the red metal wall, her eyes tracing the cylinder's length. "I've seen an image like this before," she says. "It's hard to remember, but someone I knew was trained to use this telescope. Someone I went to school with." Spingate rubs at her face. We all watch. We all wait. Because we all know what she's going through. Bits of memories are pushing their way to the surface. She stops rubbing. Hands still pressed against her face. She slides her fingers apart slightly. One eye looks at me. "Em, our school. We were all being trained to live and work on the Zolotl." She points at the image of the telescope. "Some people were trained specifically for that. The girl, she was a gear. What was her name?" Spingate makes fists, grinds them into her temples. She stops. She has it. "Okadigbo," she says. "One of the dead kids in our original coffin room on the Zolotl." I also know that name, because Brewer mentioned her. "Where is Okadigbo? Is she still alive, or did you kill her again?" "She trained for years," Spingate says. "I can't remember what her classes were exactly, but it was all she worked on." The few memories any of us have end at the age of 12. If Okadigbo had been studying for years, when did she start? The observatory, built to house a telescope. This city, built to support the observatory? If these things are true, everything we've seen is dedicated to one thing. The telescope. Why? What does it mean? What does it do? Spingate reaches out with shaking hands. Her fingertips sink into the glowing ziggurat. She turns it this way, then that, tilting, looking. "The telescope has a name," she says. "I can't quite... Damn it, what was it called?" O'Malley walks to stand next to her. He reaches a fingertip out, traces it down the length of the cylinder. "It's called," he says, searching for the word. "It's called... Is it called the Goff Spear?" That word is a hammer smashing into my brain. A word of power. Beyond power. It might be the most important word there is. Looking at the faces of my friends, I know it hits them just as hard.
"Chancellor, is Adept Okadigbo present?"
"She's not," I say, answering before O'Malley can. I don't know what an adept is. Right now I don't care. This building, or system, or computer, or whatever it is expecting Okadigbo. If it knows she's dead, it might shut down. The image of the observatory blinks out. So do Spingate's lights, leaving her again in the darkness. She's staring at me. So are the others. Something on my right hand. The hand that holds the spear. Tiny, brightly glowing dots, red and blue and yellow, coating my skin.
"Welcome, Empress Savage."
My friends exchange glances, gawk at me. O'Malley stands quietly, saying nothing. Spingate's eyes narrow. Her expression clouds over, with the same distrust she showed when we were at the statue. I don't have time to worry about her. Ometeotl hasn't asked for my access code. Maybe we can finally get answers. First, though, I need to see what dangers lie in this very room. "I am the Empress. So you have to do what I say?"
"Of course, Empress Savage."
"Good. Who is in these coffins?"
"This servant does not understand the query," Ometeotl says. "There are no coffins here."
I think of Brewer again, and a word pops into my head. "The four husks in this room," I say. "Who is in them?"
"No one, Empress."
"Open them, now." Four coffin lids open simultaneously, splitting vertically down the middle, the halves sliding neatly to the sides. All empty. The white fabric inside looks perfect, like it has never been touched. Goosebumps, cascading up my arms, down my body. Something about this place is wrong. I look to Bishop to see if he notices anything, but he doesn't seem alarmed. I push the feeling away. I have so many questions.
What is this place? What is this city?
This is the city of Ukmal, built for the free peoples of the rebellion.
That word again. Rebellion. I think of Brewer's warning that we can make a new future if we don't know the past. This world is ours to do with as we wish. But only if we survive, and to survive, we have to eat.
How do we kill the red mold?
A pause.
Empress Savage, this servant has no information on red mold.
It has to know. We can't have come this far for nothing.
We found a warehouse, I say, full of food that was contaminated with a toxin. How did the people who came before us deal with it? What did they eat? And where did those people go?
As you commanded, there have been no people before you, Empress. You are the first to set foot on Omeokan.
That makes no sense. I look at O'Malley. He doesn't understand either. Of course there were people here before us. This city didn't build itself.
The rebellion, Spingate says to the ceiling. The slaughter on the Zolotl.
She turns her head to stare at me, her gaze malevolent.
Why were those people murdered?
I freeze. They died because Matilda led an uprising, but only O'Malley and I know she was a slave, that all the circles are slaves. I should have told everyone right away. I knew it. Now it's going to come out.
O'Malley is staring at Spingate, mouth hanging open. His eyes flick to me, and all he does is blink.
The Whisperer has no idea what to do now.
I have limited information on the Zolotl,
Ometeotl says.
Empress Savage's valiant effort stopped a horrible slaughter. She led a rebellion that saved thousands of lives. Then she took control of the Zolotl and created Ukmal.
The answer leaves Spingate speechless. That wasn't what she was expecting. I'm at a loss for words, too, but for different reasons. Was my creator actually protecting people? I shake my head, try to focus. Even if Matilda was protecting people, it doesn't justify the carvings on the observatory walls, and it doesn't come close to justifying the slaughter up on the Zolotl. We saw dead circles, not dead halves and gears. Wait, we're being told this story by the same source that says we are the first ones here, ever. When we are standing in a building, it must have taken thousands of people to create. And then it hits me, a knife through my heart. Ometeotl just said that Matilda created this city. If that's true, then she created this building, which means she created Ometeotl. My father's voice echoing. History is written by the victors. The history I'm hearing now, was that written about Matilda or by her? Frustration claws at me. I can't trust anything Ometeotl says. This computer or whatever it is, it lies. Everyone lies. This place held our only hope to find out the truth, and now that hope is gone. More goosebumps. That odd feeling returns, and I suddenly know what it is. I feel like I'm being watched. Visca's focus snaps to a shadowy corner, then another. He feels it too.
Something's wrong, he says.
Bishop's brow furrows as if he agrees, but he can't define why. I smell something. A faint wisp that seems familiar. The slightest rattle of plastic. 5 flashlight beams sweep to the racks. The same bins, clearly empty, but one is rocking, just a little. Something is down here with us. Something lurking in the deep shadows. The bin stops rocking. Beams dance across the racks, but there is no movement to be seen. The smell connects. Burned toast. The same thing I smelled at the fire pit. And at the tunnel beneath the wall. We're not alone. The people from the jungle are here. I hesitate. We can confront them, but they could be violent and Spingate is with us. If anything happens to her, we have no hope of beating the mold. Attack, attack, always attack. My father's voice again. But this time he's wrong. We don't know how many enemies we face, and we don't know what weapons they have.
Bishop, I say, keeping my voice low, get us out of here.
He moves halfway to the racks, putting himself between us and the unknown danger. He crouches, axe in one hand, flashlight in the other. Visca at my side, his voice calm but insistent. Em, get in the elevator. I do as I'm told, watching the shadows all the way, waiting for someone to come rushing out of them. I enter the elevator as quietly as I can. Aramovsky, O'Malley, and Spingate follow. I can feel their fear. Visca silently walks up to Bishop, taps his big shoulder. Without either of them looking away from the racks, they walk backward right into the elevator. Bishop shuts the door. The cage rises. All I saw was that bin, Spingate says. Did anyone see anything else move?
I didn't, Bishop says. But it seems like this cage is the only way in and out.
He glances up. Whoever was down there, if they weren't alone, they could have friends waiting for us to step out. Everyone be ready to fight. We need to stay together. Get off this building and then back to the shuttle as fast as we can.
Aramovsky shakes his head.
We can't leave. We have to go back down. Finally learn who we are.
This building? This temple? We need to bring everyone here. We need to live here.
Live in a building covered in images of human sacrifice? Get answers from a machine voice that is either wrong or lying? And then there's the obvious. Someone was down there. Someone who was watching us. The fire builders. Aramovsky is almost right. We might have to come back, but not for the reasons he thinks. We have 5 days of rations left. If we don't find food soon, if Spingate can't beat the mold, then we will capture the people in the observatory and force them to tell us what they know. I will come back here with all the Circle Stars.
We return to the shuttle, I say. The observatory isn't safe.
Aramovsky starts to protest, but I thonk the spear down on the cage floor.
No one is allowed to come here, I say. No one.
Heads nod. Even Aramovsky's. The cage's rise slows. I feel lighter. Then it stops. The doors open. We see the stairs leading up.
21. Wind roars down the wide streets, channeled by the buildings on either side. Rain blasts us from all directions, but we dare not stop. We are being hunted. Visca carries Spingate in his arms. O'Malley stumbles, more than runs, the last of his energy long since spent. Up ahead, Bishop waves madly for us to come his way. He's at the street corner, half hidden by the base layer of a small ziggurat. He can't call to us, because the spider is so close it might hear even over the wind-driven rustle of a million leaves. Visca reaches him first, Aramovsky right on his heels. O'Malley falls hard. I drag him to his feet, shove him on. Then Bishop is there, tosses O'Malley over one big shoulder, grabs my hand and yanks me around the corner. I'm thrown to the ground next to Spingate, who silently sobs, her elbow clutched to her chest. Before I can get up, O'Malley lands hard next to me. Visca covers us with a thick sheet of vines.
Stay still, Bishop hisses. Be silent.
Seconds pass. I stare through the vines out to the dark street. Clouds transform Omeokan's twin moons into hazy, glowing spots of blue and maroon. The few trees growing up from ziggurat plateaus bend beneath the stiff wind. Our coveralls keep our bodies mostly dry, but the rain runs down our faces and under our collars. No one was waiting for us atop the observatory. It was pitch black, the stars blocked by heavy clouds. Halfway down, the skies opened up. Steep steps were treacherous enough before rain made the vines slick, before high winds blasted us. We only had 2 layers left when Spingate fell and cracked her elbow on the stone. She thinks it's broken. We followed Visca's route back from the observatory, but this time we weren't alone. Over the wind, we heard a whine, the sound of the spider that almost caught us at the city gate. It's looking for us, and it's getting closer. The whine is much louder now. What are we doing? Aramovsky whispers from behind me. We need to get to the shuttle.
Bishop's hand shoots through the vines, grabs him by the throat.
Be quiet.
We've changed directions so many times I have no idea where we are. But Visca says we're not far from the shuttle. If we can lose the spider, we'll soon be safe. The deluge pours down, unstoppable. I stare out at the dark intersection as the whine grows louder still, and wonder if maybe, just this once, I should pray to Aramovsky's gods. A flash of movement. The spider is visible for only a moment as it rushes down the street we were just on, and then is gone from sight. Seconds pass. We wait for it to come back and kill us. The seconds become minutes. Bishop finally releases Aramovsky, then steps to the corner and peeks out. I'm watching him, but as soon as he stops moving, his camouflage soaks him into the night shadows like water vanishing into a sponge. He waves us forward. We crest the vine wall, look down at our shuttle. We made it. Circle stars rush out to help. Gaston beats them to us, goes straight to Spingate. Someone carries O'Malley, hands help me. I'm not sure whose. The shuttle's warmth welcomes me. Someone lays me down in my coffin. Then Smith is there, asking me questions in a harsh, clipped tone. I answer as best I can. No, I'm not hurt. You're holding up three fingers. Now two. Yes, I just want to sleep. Then she's gone, saying she has to operate on Spingate's elbow. Just like before, O'Malley is in the coffin to my right, Bishop in the one to my left. They're both already asleep. I lie back in mine. My lid closes. It's dark, cramped, but this time I don't care. As the world around me goes quiet, the questions in my head roar out loud. Who are the people in the observatory? Are they grown-ups? Or are they young people like us? Blank kids who somehow found a way down here before we did. Could they be a group that has nothing to do with the Zolotl at all? Perhaps people who were here before that ship's thousand-year journey even began? Ometeotl said Matilda was a hero, that she saved lives. That's a lie, isn't it? Was Matilda fighting against evil, at least in the beginning? Part of me desperately wants to believe that. A bigger part of me wants to block out the thoughts of something even more disturbing. What if Matilda started out doing the right thing, protecting people, then power changed her, made her into a monster? If power changed her, power could change me. I try to push the thought away, but it refuses to let go. Right up until exhaustion finally drags me into darkness. 22. I wake to bad news, and from an unexpected source.
Get up, Em, Zubiri says. The mold has spread.
I roll over, nestle my face into my coffin's padding. If I ignored her, maybe I can sleep for another 15 minutes. A hand on my shoulder shaking me.
Em, it's serious.
Gaston's voice. I groan. I roll to my back, blink against the shuttle's bright lights. Gaston and Zubiri are leaning in over me. So is skinny Borjigin. I notice that his face is smooth, hairless. All the other boys my age are showing some stubble. Even little Gaston. But not Borjigin. I wonder if that's the way his creator made him. The two boys look worried. Their eyes are flicking around the room, as if to watch out for anyone listening too close. Zubiri is as calm as she can be. Few other people are up. It must be early in the morning. How serious? I ask. Borjigin looks at his inner forearm. His sleeves are rolled up. He's written numbers on his skin.
We have one day's worth of food left, he says. Maybe. And that's if we cut everyone's rashes in half.
One day? I try to sit up. Thunderous aches in my legs stop me. My thighs feel like they're made of bricks. I'm so sore from the observatory climb. Gaston grips my shoulders, helps me rise.
You're counting wrong, I say to Borjigin. We have to have more than that.
Gaston shakes his head.
He has a full inventory of everything on the shuttle. He knows our food situation down to the calorie.
I don't care. Borjigin hasn't been part of the decision-making process. It's been me, O'Malley, Bishop, Gaston, and... I notice Zubiri is wearing a golden bracer.
Where's Spingate? I ask.
Medical, Gaston says. Her elbow will be fine. Smith wants her to rest a little longer, though. It's one thing after another. Why can't someone bring me good news for a change?
We have 5 days left, I say. What happened?
I told you, the mold, Zubiri says, her tone matter of fact. She runs her hand over the bracer.
Spingate was hurt, so I asked Gaston if I could use this. I adjusted the sensitivity levels so I could scan food that was still inside sealed containers.
Her little face, so innocent. She can't be right. She's just a child.
Zubiri surprised me too, Gaston says. She knows how to use the bracer better than Spingate does.
We're all the same age, basically. But I guess I assumed that because we looked older, we were smarter. That was stupid. I need to trust that the younger kids are just as capable as I am.
I think the mold is a weapon, Zubiri says. Bioengineered to destroy food stores. It secretes a chemical that makes microscopic holes in the bins so it can get at the food.
A weapon? If Zubiri is right, that explains why all the food in the warehouse was bad. And come tomorrow, I'll have hundreds of hungry people on my hands. I think we only have 3 options. Defeat the mold ourselves, find safe food, or find the fire builders. Spingate and Zubiri should keep working in the lab. Maybe they can figure it out. The jungle is full of life. If we search, we might discover plants or animals that are safe to eat. And while doing that, we can return to the fire pit. Visca is a tracker. Maybe he can track the fire builders. If those 3 efforts fail, a return trip to the observatory will be our last chance.
Gaston, wake up Bishop and Visca, I say. We're going back to the jungle. We head out beneath a sky that glows yellow-orange with morning light. My group consists of Bishop, Visca, Coyote, Borjigin, and a young tooth girl named C. Callie. Callie has a 2nd bracer and knows how to use it. She'll check any food we find. I'd rather have Spingate, but her arm will be in a sling for another day, and it makes more sense for her to continue the mold research. Zubiri will assist her. Or is Spingate now assisting Zubiri? O'Malley stays behind as well. He's wiped out from the observatory climb. We all are. But he's worse off than the rest of us. I leave him in charge of organizing a larger search of surrounding buildings. We're out of time and can't afford to play it safe. Everyone will be involved. I'll also have him put Aramovsky to work. Have the tall boy so busy he doesn't have time to spread lies. My food ration is so small it easily fits in my coverall pockets, along with some bandages, a water bottle, a few medical supplies, and my flashlight. I don't even need a bag. 1 small grain bar and a cube of protein. Perhaps my last meal. At least the last one that isn't full of poison. Moving as silently as we can, we head for the city gate. The rain has dropped off to a drizzle. The sun is out again, making this city of vine-covered pyramids gleam as if it is sweating from the heat. We stay close to buildings, ready to hide under vines at the first sign of a spider. Bishop, Visca, and Coyote are far out in front, scanning for threats, leaving me with Borjigin and Callie. She keeps sliding the loose bracer back up her forearm. It clearly wasn't intended for a small, rail-thin 12-year-old. She and Borjigin each carry a knife, sheathed on their thighs.
I don't understand why I have to go, Borjigin says. It's the 4th time he said that. I try to stay patient.
You know our food situation better than anyone, I say. If we find any, you'll figure out how far it will go, how many people will need to carry it back to the others, stuff like that.
I can do logistics from the shuttle. Someone could just report back to me. It's dangerous out here.
Shut up, Callie says without looking at him, without breaking stride. I'm half your size. And you don't hear me complaining about the danger. We do this or we die. Stop being a goddamned baby. Bordigan glares at her. Callie ignores him. I'm not happy this little girl curses, but I like her already. She has curly blonde hair that sticks up more than it hangs down. It reminds me of Latu's hair, so I try not to look at it. Just listen to the circle stars, I say. If you want to survive, do exactly what they tell you. Callie says, yes, ma'am. But Bordigan blanches. Maybe his definition of dangerous didn't include the possibility of him dying. We walk on in silence. It takes us 4 or 5 hours to reach the city wall. We join the circle stars at the gate. The tall doors are closed, just as we left them a few nights ago. Still no sign of spiders, Bishop says. Everyone on the door. Together. Now, push. The six of us lean against the thick metal slab. The hinges screech, and the solid door slowly opens a crack. We slide through. Best to leave it open a little, as we don't know if we'll have to come back this way again. The jungle ruins lie before us. I'd hoped I might see a smoke column snaking into the sky, but no such luck. Of course, it can't be that easy. Bishop scans the tree line. I do the same, but I know he will see any danger long before I do. Even danger I would never see at all. Looks clear, he says. Visca, go. Visca moves out, the vine-choked wall on his right, his eyes fixed on the ground. He thinks he can follow the trail we left a few nights back, which should lead straight to the fire pit. That saves Bishop and me the time of trying to remember where we were when we first found it. From there, Visca will look for signs of the fire builders. Bishop gives Visca a head start, then follows. I'm next, then Callie, then Bordigan, with Coyote guarding our rear. I still don't like this, Bordigan says. I hear animals in the jungle. What if they attack us? Callie sighs and shakes her head. Coyote pats his thigh bone against his open palm. Don't worry, Bordigan, he says, smiling wide. If anything happens, I'll protect you. Bishop stops, turns, waves me forward. Visca has found our trail. The midday sun beats down, hot on my hair and face whenever it punches through the canopy. Mist curls up from the muddy ground, from water beaded on yellow leaves. The jungle simmers in a low-hanging mist. Despite this steamy heat, despite scratching branches, the jungle's natural beauty grips me. Brightly colored blurs whiz through the air. We hear small animals scurrying in the underbrush. Maybe those animals are what the mystery people cooked in their fire. Callie stops every time she sees a new plant, waves the bracer over it, and every time she says the same thing, non-edible. Finally, Visca leads us to the fire pit. It's now a puddle of black water filled with wet charcoal. The five-walled building shows no sign of anyone having been here since we left. I'll start a sweep, Visca says, and creeps off into the jungle. Let's rest, Bishop says. Stay inside the walls, out of sight. Spiders could be out here. Bordigan is only too happy to sit. Callie waves her bracer over moss on the walls. At first, I think she's being ridiculous. Then my stomach rumbles, and I wonder if moss is tasty. The bracer jewels flash orange. Looks like I don't have to worry about that. I find a place to sit and rub at my sore thighs. They've loosened up some, but still ache plenty. Bishop drops down next to me. He takes a drink from his water bottle, then offers it to me. That's so nice of him. I take a swig, hand it back. Do you think Visca will find a trail? He shrugs. Maybe, but don't get your hopes up. He's way better at it than I am, though. Perhaps. I found a path, Visca calls out. Bishop is up instantly. In moments, we are on the move again. At first, I couldn't see the path. I just kept following Bishop, who was following Visca. After 2 hours of marching through the jungle, though, I recognize it, could easily follow it on my own. At eye level, I see it as a narrow gap winding through the underbrush. At my feet, it is a wet, irregular strip of brown, notched in among the creepers and ground cover. Shallow depressions filled with water might be footprints, although there is no way to tell how big the feet were. On either side of the path, branches scrape at us, vines smear us with juice. The going is tiring and messy, and I don't care. The fire builders made this path. It has to lead us to them. I hear my footsteps, the rustle of vines and fronds being pushed aside before flapping back into place. As usual, the circle stars don't make a sound, except for Coyote, far behind us. I can hear his movements. Callie makes very little noise, perhaps because she's tiny, but Borjigan is so loud, he might as well be shouting. Bishop raises a fist. Callie and I stop instantly. Borjigan stumbles into us, making all kinds of noise.
Sorry, he says.
Bishop strides toward us.
Borjigan, please be quiet,
he says, making a visible effort to control his annoyance.
Watch where you step. Put your heel down first, then let your weight roll forward to the ball of your foot.
Borjigan nods quickly, intimidated.
Good, Bishop says. You're behind M, so just watch how she does it.
Bishop slides silently forward to join Visca, and we're moving again. Borjigan glances at me, nervous and awkward. Despite the heat of the jungle, my face feels even hotter than it did a few moments ago. Bishop pointed me out as an example of how to move quietly. I'm stunned, embarrassed in a good way. I can't even get my head around it. He's impressed by what I can do, not just by the way I look or my position as leader. In my short memory, in everything I can recall from Matilda's childhood, what Bishop just said is the best thing anyone has ever said to me. I walk, Callie right behind me. Borjigan isn't as loud as before, but he sure isn't quiet. I make each step a careful thing. I don't want to let Bishop down. The jungle's animal noises fade, then die out. Save for the buzzing of the birds, everything is silent. Neither Bishop nor Visca raise a fist, but they don't have to. We all stop walking. Something is coming. Something that the animals fear. A new sound. A rustling. A fast scurrying across dead leaves and past soft vines. Bishop looks at me, makes a motion for me to hide. I kneel, look back down the trail. Callie is already out of sight, but Borjigan is standing there like an idiot.
Borjigan, I whisper. Get down!
He looks at me, dumbstruck and afraid, then slips under a yellowish-green plant with leaves bigger than he is. The rustling increases. I hear it from several areas at once, all to my right. Something is coming our way. A creature runs across the trail, brown with yellowish spots, four legs, about the size of the pigs we saw in the Zolotl. It doesn't have eyes like us, but rather a line of three shiny black dots down each side of its strange head. The creature vanishes into the underbrush on the other side of the trail.
Could we kill that? Eat it?
I remember how good the pig tasted. On my side of the trail, rattling and rustling, more of the odd brown creatures following the first, and behind them, something strange. It looks like a big snake, dirty yellow and as thick as my thigh, silently rising up from the underbrush. Long, wicked-looking barbed pincers spread wide, ready to strike. A second brown animal scurries across the trail, then another, and another. A chubby little one scrambles between Borjigan and me, smaller than the rest. It must be a baby. Its foot catches on a root. It stumbles forward, rolling, splashing up mud. It is so close I could reach out and grab it. The snake thing shoots forward. Pincers snap together, punching through the little animal's flesh. The baby squeals in pain and terror. The snake rises up, its prey held between the pincers. Short legs kick helplessly. Pinkish blood pours down. The underbrush shudders and parts as something big rises up. The snake is only part of this predator. Some kind of elongated nose. The beast stands on four long legs. Tawny fur splotched with brown stripes. Below where the thick snake meets the head, a wide mouth filled with white teeth as long as my fingers. powerful shoulders and chest slim to narrower hips and muscular legs. Just like with the pig creatures, the three glistening black dots on either side of the head must be its eyes. The baby squeals, so loud. The snake trunk suddenly whips down, smashing the baby into the trail so hard, I feel the impact through the ground. The squeals change to wet grunts. The snake lifts it again. The baby is still twitching, then slams it down again. No more grunts, no more movement. The snake trunk curls inward, placing the dead animal into the long-toothed maw. Close, chew, crunch, swallow. The snake trunk suddenly rises up, stops. I see four little flesh spots on the end, above the pincers. They open, draw in air, close, open. My blood runs cold. Does it smell me? The snake trunk twists this way and that, sniffing. The monster's head is heavy, bony. Beneath the dirty fur, I see twitching muscle and shapes of ribs so flat and thick, they make me think of armor. Its chest is a solid plate of curved bone, a shade darker than its fur. My hands tighten on my spear. If this thing attacks, I don't even know where to stab it. Sniff, sniff. Without a sound, Bishop is crouching next to me, axe clutched in his hands. The snake swings to Borjigin's plant. The only thing between him and those gore-smeared pincers is a single wide, thin leaf. Sniff, sniff. The yellow-furred animal takes a step back. The trunk contorts. The pincers lurch up and away. A stream of goo shoots from each of the nostrils. Did it just sneeze? The beast turns and runs into the jungle. As big as it is, it instantly vanishes into the underbrush. A few moments pass. Then, almost as if someone slowly turns a hidden dial, noise returns to the jungle. Coyote slides out of the jungle onto the trail, runs past us, straight to Borjigin's plant. Coyote rips the leaf away, revealing a shaking, terrified boy, then kneels, puts his arm around Borjigin, and speaks so softly I can't hear. Bishop and I stand. I feel wobbly, like I was just in a fight, even though nothing touched me. I don't understand, I say. Why didn't it attack? That little animal couldn't have been more than a mouthful. Visca appears as unexpectedly as Bishop did. I will never get used to how the circle stars move with such silence. We didn't smell right, Visca says. We must not smell like food. Callie steps out of the underbrush. An allergic reaction, perhaps, she says. Maybe it has never smelled anything like us before. Bishop shakes his head. I doubt that. Someone built the fire pit. Someone built the city. There are people on Omeokan. Visca shrugs. Then our clothes, maybe? Could be a smell on those. More questions for which we do not have answers. We keep moving, Bishop says. The next animal might like the way we smell. Visca, move out. Visca turns and walks down the trail, barely making a sound. I'm supposed to be in charge. But out here, Bishop is giving the orders. That's fine for now. My pounding heart is crushing my chest and lungs. I don't think I could focus on anything other than staying on the trail. Bishop points at Borjigin. And you need to be quiet. Coyote steps between them. Leave him alone, Bishop. He's doing the best he can. Borjigin says nothing, just stands there shivering. Bishop glares at Borjigin, then at Coyote. Then turns and heads down the trail. We walk through the jungle. Tiny bugs are starting to land on me, but they don't bite. It's more annoying than anything else. That big predator scared the hell out of me. An hour later and I'm still not feeling right. It was like a bear or a giant wolf, with an elephant's trunk that ended in ant pincers. What do we even call it? Snake wolf? Bear bug? Hard to think of a name. Because there are no easy comparisons to Matilda's memories. The buzzing of the blurts, the hoots of unseen animals echoing through the canopy, the heat, the humidity, the red sun blazing off yellow leaves. We are in so much trouble right now, yet my love for Omeokan overwhelms me. This is my home. It was my home before I ever set foot here. I don't want to be anyplace else. Not ever.
Up ahead, Visca stops. He holds up a fist. Bishop jogs back to us. The leaves seem to part for him. He seems to slide through them, as if he has no substance at all.
He puts one arm around Callie, the other around me, nods toward a tree trunk on the right side of the path. He wants us to hide. The three of us kneel behind the tree trunk. I look around. Visca has vanished. Borjigin is on the other side of the trail, hiding behind a fallen log. Coyotl is with him, vine wrapped and nearly invisible. The wind changes slightly. I catch a faint wisp of burned toast. Then, I hear it. A noise, soft, regular. Branches sliding off something. A faint crackle of twigs snapping underfoot. This is it. We've found the fire builders. My breathing sounds so loud. My heart hammers. Will they accept us? Teach us how to hunt and prepare food? Can our two cultures live side by side? Or will this go the other way? Will we have to force them to tell us how to survive? I see movement down the path. Through the yellow leaves, I glimpse a flash of red and green. Will they be young like us, or old like the grown-ups? The fire builder comes around a thick tree trunk into view. My stomach drops. The fire builders, who lurked in the observatory's shadows, who smell like burned toast. They aren't like us. They aren't grown-ups. They aren't people at all.
23. Borjigin's hiss of fear slices through the jungle. The fire builder stops. Underbrush and dangling vines partially obscure it. It's not an animal. Animals don't carry tools. Is that a club it's holding? I feel numb. Not the blanked-out sensation I've grown used to. This is something else. A feel of nothingness. It wears rags for clothing. Frayed strips of yellow, green, and blue, the colors of the jungle, tied around long, thin, strong arms. Between the strips of cloth, I see wrinkled, dark blue skin. It is almost my height, head wider and longer than mine. Eyes, three of them, middle one set slightly above the bottom two, a shallow triangle of eyes that flick about, searching. Even from a distance, their color jumps out. Bright blue like O'Malley's. Below the eyes, a wide mouth. Purple lips curved downward in an exaggerated frown. Matilda's memories struggle to define what I see. A flash fire of images. Toad mouth, frog mouth, fish mouth. That head swivels suddenly, looks left. The creature comes closer, pushing past encroaching branches. Something strange about the way it moves. I see its legs now, rag-tied, thick and powerful, bent like it's sitting on an invisible chair. The creature is leaning forward, so much so I don't understand why it doesn't fall flat on its strange face. Both legs push down at the same time, softly springing the creature forward. Not a step, a hop, both long feet coming off the trail. It lands silently. The three blue eyes flick down the trail, side to side. I think it heard Borjigin and is searching for the source of the sound. The fire builder turns, looks back the way it came, and I see why it doesn't fall. A tail, long and thick, balances out the forward lean. It turns our way again, still searching, still wary. Strange long hands adjust their grip on the club. Two fingers, not four. Thicker than ours, as is the long thumb. Arms are wiry, corded with muscle. That club bothers me, but I don't know why. Long and thin like the handle of Farrar's shovel, but half wood, half metal. Nothing dangerous on the tip. No axe head, no spear blade. The club widens and flattens at the other end, the end held close to its body. Maybe that part is for smashing things. Just like Visca's sledgehammer. A tap on my arm. Bishop, both hands on his red axe, nostrils flaring, staring at me. He gives his axe a single shake, asking me a silent question.
Should I kill it? Is this creature alone? If it spots one of us, will it sound an alarm? It doesn't seem to be wearing anything like the grown-ups' bracelets, nothing that could hit us from a distance. Bishop can surprise it, kill it quick. This thing isn't like us. It is other, and we face so many threats already. I don't know what to do. Blue eyes scan the trail, the underbrush. Two small hops bring the creature closer. It wears a lattice on its chest, kind of like a necklace. It's made of bones. A bulging bag hangs from its hip. Only a few steps away now. It wouldn't have time to react before Bishop buries his axe in that wide head. I glance across the trail. From my angle, Borjigin is barely visible behind a covering of wide leaves.